My name is Michael McQuarrie. I'm an associate professor of sociology here at the LSC and a sometimes avid researcher on democratic institutions, which means that it is also my distinct pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event. I'm also a research associate at LSC Cities, which is hosting tonight's event. LSC Cities is an international center at the London School of Economics and Political Science, supported by Deutsche Bank, that carries out research education and outreach activities in London and abroad. Its mission is to study how people and cities interact in a rapidly urbanizing world, focusing on how the design of cities impacts on society, culture, and the environment. The precipitating event that prompted the organization of tonight's discussion is the launch of the Commonwealth Local Government Handbook. This is a biennial publication of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. The Commonwealth Local Government Forum works to promote and strengthen democratic local government across the Commonwealth and to encourage the exchange of best practices through conferences and events, technical assistance, projects, and research. The handbook provides a comparative overview of local government and decentralization across the countries of the Commonwealth. The handbook and the discussion tonight is particularly salient in this moment when democratic institutions are experiencing something of a legitimation crisis in many parts of the globe, as well as direct and increasingly concerted political attack. But just as importantly, provides an excuse and a justification for this event, which brings together a group of truly exceptional, people who have a truly exceptional amount of practical policy and academic knowledge about local government, multi-level government, and the contemporary challenges that confront democracies. Tonight, we will be hearing presentations from Helen Clark and Yves Leterme. Helen Clark has had a distinguished career in government as a party leader and prime minister in New Zealand and as a senior administrator for the United Nations. She is also the patron of the Commonwealth and Local Government Forum. Yves Leterme has likewise had a distinguished career in government. He was also a party leader and prime minister of Belgium. During part of his tenure, he was also the president of the European Union. He has served as the deputy secretary general for the OECD, and currently he is the secretary general of the intergovernmental organization, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. After we hear from our terrific speakers, we will turn to a panel discussion, which will also include Daryl Bradley, who is president of the Belize Mayors Association and a board member of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. He is a lawyer and former mayor of Belize City. Helena Zhao, who leads Microsoft UK's City Next program for smart cities. And finally, the LSE's own Tony Travers. Professor Travers directs two centers here at the LSE, the Institute for Public Affairs and LSE London. He is also intimately involved with policy issues around local and regional government here in the UK and is one of the school's foremost experts on governance issues. After the panel, we will then have a Q&A with the audience, and we will hear from Greg Munro, the Commonwealth Local Government Forum Secretary General. The Twitter hashtag for tonight's event is #LSEDemocracy. And with that, I will ask you to silence your cell phones, although still feel free to tweet. The LSE is big on tweeting, so bonus points if you do. I will ask you to silence your cell phones, and if you haven't, then please welcome all of our distinguished guests to the LSE and our first presenter, Helen Clark, to the podium.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm very pleased to be here in my capacity as a patron of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. This actually goes with having hosted the forum for its biennial conference. And when Carl Wright was Secretary General in 2007, the forum's Commonwealth-wide conference came to New Zealand. We're very privileged to host it. And I think we could say the Kiwis have been playing quite a part of the forum for a number of years and very happy to do so. So I thought tonight we've got quite a broad-ranging discussion because apart from the Commonwealth Local Government Forum report, we also have this very interesting report of Eve's organisation on the global state of democracy. So I thought my comments could usefully range across the two reports. So firstly, can I commend Greg Munro and Lucy and the Local Government Forum of the Commonwealth for putting together the handbook. I mean, I have been looking through the detailed profiles that I was sent in advance. And for a student studying local government, this is a Bible, because it tells you everything you would want to know about local government in each of the countries of the Commonwealth. It tells you a little about the national government and then how the local government organisation sits aside alongside that. It looks at what is the legal basis for local government. Now, this is actually a very interesting question, because some countries are inclined to prescribe very, very closely the form of local government. Others, like my own government, passed empowering legislation for local government. We said, we're not going to tell you what your job is. The only thing you can't do is run the country's foreign affairs and defence policy, but anything else, if you can get the agreement of your constituents through participatory planning processes, that can go into your plan and you can do it. We empowered local government. Local government loved it, of course, because they didn't want to be, for the most part, slotted into being told their job was removing the rubbish and keeping the roads clean. They had ideas about social and economic development. So to empower them is kind of the other end of the spectrum from the very narrow prescription of role. Looking at the structure of local government, it tells us in the Commonwealth what is the role of a minister of local government. Now, again, in some countries it may be very directive. In others it may be, in a sense, to work closely and collaboratively with local government and work on the policy issues which need to go into legislation. It looks at types of council. It looks at elections. Now, in my observation, often countries will experiment a little bit more with electoral systems at the local level than they will at the national level. You can get some diversity. So the report tells us about that diversity. It also looks at who is represented. Now, this is something we've been discussing a lot at the Commonwealth Women's Forum today, because clearly gender parity is not a factor in women's elective representation anywhere, globally or in the Commonwealth, at national level or at local level. And one issue of interest is to what extent local government is an entry point for women coming into politics. In my own country, it has tended to be a bit of an entry point, that people come up through local elections and step into the national scene from there. The report tells us about systems for community involvement. That's one thing that the New Zealand empowering legislation is very clear on. If local government is going to be given its head, it needs the consent of its constituents. So the plan, the consultation mechanisms, all this is very important. And interesting also that the report is picking up on the role of ICT in citizen engagement. We can do so much more now to engage constituencies with the modern ICT, crowdsourcing ideas, crowdsourcing participation and so on. It looks at how the local government associations in countries are organised. And one interesting initiative of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum to note is that it has formed a Women in Local Government network, and this is to be rolled out through the local government associations. You really need the local government association bringing all the councils together to be strong for that to work. Report comments on monitoring systems, what are the transparency and accountabilities, how the audit offices work and so on. Then the issue of finance. Now, any meeting of local government one goes to, the issue of money is raised, because often empowerment doesn't go so far as giving local authorities the ability to source revenue from whatever, wherever they like. Local governments in so many countries depend on the rates, which may be quite a small base, on charging for services, which is never popular. I've never found people really like to pay for the water rate or various other things. And often they depend on quite a lot of devolved central government funding. So this is always a live debate, and I think the report is quite interesting in setting out the different kinds of arrangements that they are. And then there's the issue of what services. is local government actually responsible for? And there's such a huge variety of that. And that leads me to make a point about the importance of local government in the global sustainable development agenda. As with the previous Millennium Development Goal agenda, and to commend the local government forum in Carl's era for really embracing the Millennium Development Goals and sort of coaxing, exhorting, encouraging local government to take those seriously, and now Greg and Lucy with the Sustainable Development Goals, because the truth is, without the engagement of local government, you can't achieve these goals. So often, the areas that need action are areas within the competence of local government. And so it's been a great thrill for me with my recent years leading UNDP and the UN Development System to see Commonwealth Local Government Forum really pick up the Sustainable Development Goals and run with them. I often observe that in Western countries, we're by and large given up national planning. That's seen as old hat. Actually, in developing countries, which are still very strong on national strategic planning, in a sense, they're more equipped to take forward the sustainable development goals because it sort of fits into a national planning framework. But what Western countries still have largely is planning at the local level. And that's why I think we could probably make, in many ways, more progress with the SDGs through our municipal and regional and provincial governments than perhaps we'll make with the non-planning systems of central government. I think if you know, I have a message as a patron of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum to central governments. It is, firstly, work collaboratively with local government. There's no point having antagonistic relationships. You have to work together. One of the initiatives I took as Prime Minister in New Zealand was to set up with the head of the Local Government Association, Basil Morrison, who has played a very important role in the forum for quite a number of years. We had a central local government forum twice a year, every year, and the officials always developed an agenda. The central and local politicians would meet, would bring in senior ministers, the senior leaders of the local government association. We would go through the agenda, we'd agree on what had to be done. When we came back 6 months later, we wanted to know that we were ticking off that the agenda we had jointly agreed on would be implemented. I think that was a benefit to both of us. So I'm strongly in favour of getting collaborative relationships between central and local government. My second point would be to central governments which haven't kind of freed up local government to really look at empowering it so that they can act according to how they assess the needs of their constituencies. Thirdly, I think the revenue-raising issues probably need to be revisited in many countries because the sort of hand-to-mouth, limited rating base kind of arrangements don't serve communities as well as they should. Apart from the Global Sustainable Development Agenda, of course, you have the companion agenda, which came from Habitat 3, the new urban agenda, which I see as, in a way, an urban interpretation or local government interpretation of the sustainable development agenda, but what it has to say about sustainable and resilient cities is extremely important and should be embraced. Now, the other part of tonight is, of course, some commentary around the global state of democracy, and let me just make a very few comments about that. I think we are in, you know, one of those not-so-good moments for democracy. I'd make the same point about multilateralism. It's not necessarily a good time. We see quite a lot of regression. And in my opinion, a lot of Western countries, developed countries, EU countries, aren't putting on a great show at the moment. We have seen the rise of populism. It was on a very interesting panel at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg last November at their Global Democracy Conference or Forum, opining on populism and why it was a problem. I said it was a problem for three reasons. One, populists undermine institutions, including those by which they came to power. Secondly, they stigmatise vulnerable groups in a community and whip sentiment up against them, and migrants present a ready target for a number of them, but there are other groups that are vulnerable too, who you see sentiment whipped up against. And then thirdly, they tend to come up with very simplistic solutions to rather complex problems, which if implemented would probably make things considerably worse. But you know, it is a bit of a trend of our times to see populism of left and right in the Western democracies having a resurgence. Now, we also see some regression in regions which had seen a surge of democratisation. If we looked, for example, towards Central and Eastern Europe, I don't think I need to say anything more specific, but some of the examples there, which are rather discouraging. Latin America also has seen something of a rollback as well. In several regions, we see the extension of presidential terms over what was ever envisaged. And the term limits on presidents were always about ensuring that there was some turnover in power. But we see very strong leaders now saying, well, no, l'état c'est moi. I'm going to be around for as long as I want, not as long as the old constitution said. So I think there are really quite a lot of worrying trends. We're also seeing in a number of places targeted killings and serious assaults on opposition politicians and journalists. And this is something that's happening from, shall we say, Malta to Mozambique. Slovakia, more recently, there was outrage in the streets about what had happened to a prominent journalist. Often, they are investigating corruption. Who actually took out the contract for the killing is often a bit of a mystery, but for sure organised crime had a hand, and usually the investigation is sort of leading into where organised crime had inroads into political systems. So it's not a great moment, and I'm very pleased that IDEA does do the assessment on the global state of democracy. It may be your survey, Eves, which suggested that only 5% of people in our world live in what are judged to be fully democratic countries. At least someone's made that assessment recently. And then you go into the flawed democracies along the spectrum to the no democracy at all. But I think this should be an issue of concern to us. So those are my opening comments. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Without any transition, I take the floor. Thank you for having me here. I have at least three reasons why I'm happy to be here tonight at this very meeting here, specific meeting in London. The first one being, Helen, that we can celebrate the 10th anniversary of our first meeting. I don't know if you remember, but I had very prudent first steps on the international scene, and I remember very well the NATO summit in 2008 in Bucharest. And there was a leaders-only dinner at night, and I had to leave my delegation to go to that leaders-only meeting, which was my first international meeting as leader of the opposition, winning the elections, coming into power. Then you go to Bucharest. And there was a leaders-only meeting with people like Mr. Bush, Sarkozy. I think that even Putin was invited to that dinner. And so I was a bit shy, and I was wondering myself, where will I sit down? And there were, of course, nameplates, and I happened to sit next to Helen Clark. We said hello and who are you and so on. And then, so that's the first reason. Brings me to the second reason, the conversation we then had. Helen Clark asked me, do you know the Kleine Roeselarestraat in your place? And I happen to be from a place that has a very historic dimension. But of course, that struck me. It was an astonishing question because there was a street maybe 200 meters from where I lived then. And so a New Zealand prime minister at the NATO summit in Bucharest asked me how things were going in the street some 200 meters from my place. Brings me to the second reason why I'm happy to be here. It's Commonwealth. As a child of Flanders Fields, I'm always happy to meet people from the Commonwealth. We never forget in my place what respect the Commonwealth deserves, and the populations, the nations of the Commonwealth that put enormous sacrifices to liberate Ypres, Flanders Fields, and of course Western Europe 100 years ago, 1918. Brings me to the third reason. My first mandate in politics, and also my last one, was at the local level. Started as an alderman, ended as the chair of the city council. But I'm not there to expand on this very lovely night in Bucharest or on the Flanders Fields or on local politics in Ypres. I'm here to introduce, as a kind of introduction to the conversation later, our latest report, which is in fact the first edition of a report that should be published now from now on every 2 years. When I took over the leadership, coming from the OECD, leadership of this institution, I discovered an institution that didn't have a benchmarking, standard-setting publication about the state in its domain of activity. So that's the reason why we decided to work on this. This publication is a bit specific because it's not like Freedom House, for instance, or Transparency International, publishing a ranking of countries and evaluating on figures every year and publishing a ranking of countries. The ambition is to indeed have statistics, and you will find a lot of numbers, figures, but to analyze a bit more with more historical perspective and more in-depth the situation. So in the following 15 to 20 minutes, I would like to walk you through the global state of democracy, the GSOD, the first edition. Of course, this publication is about a kind of diagnosis of where we stand with democracy. But very typical and contrary to Freedom House, for instance, we try to take a historic perspective and to be very nuanced in our assessment. Nevertheless, as we all witness, we can say also based on our statistics that democracy is at a critical juncture. And I will try in the short time that the organizers very rightly gave me, I will try to elaborate a little bit on four or five what I would call negative trends, then some of the positive findings, to end then with a couple of specifics for local authorities. So what we see is that indeed democracy is challenged, meets lots of very demanding challenges. The first one, I don't know if I'm with the... the first one being what we call democratic backsliding. It's important to appropriate, to own this concept, because very typical for the last 10, 15 years is that contrary to what happened in the 70s, the 80s, we don't see so much countries going from a democratic governance via coup d'etat or via electoral fraud, or via civil war to from democracy to dictatorship, or the other way around. What we see more is democratic backsliding, which means corrosion of democracy from within, with very typical examples like Venezuela, Turkey, Thailand, Hungary, Poland. Helen Clark was so kind just to vaguely say an abstract Central and Eastern Europe, but I want to name the countries where you see democratic reversals. These democratic reversals characterized by manipulation of democratic processes, governments extending their mandates through constitutional amendments with increase of the concentration of power in executive branches, or undermine the independence of the judiciary, or limit political freedoms, or independent media, and so on. But so the first negative tendency is this kind of democratic backsliding, which is an erosion of the quality of democracy from within, where you see this, let's say, at first sight, democracies, but that tend to be very hybrid democracies, where countries are adopting the formal characteristics of democracy, for instance, including periodic elections, while in fact, in reality, allowing very little real competition for power. And we see that when checks and balances of a democracy are weakened, that the quality of the debate also goes downwards. This brings me to my second point, which has also been touched upon by Helen. It is the issue of populism and nationalism. So the weakening, the internal erosion of the practice, the strengths, the checks and balances of democracies gives way to the rise of populism and nationalism, with, of course, sometimes very skilled leaders that are able to corrode democracies from within, very skilled leaders at exploiting electorates' insecurities, dissatisfactions, and adopting a, as was mentioned, simplistic, divisive, and fear-driven rhetoric on issues like globalization, like corruption, like migration, religious extremism, and so on. To add, of course, and this comes close to the simplistic aspect of the way they use politics and they use democratic tools, this comes close to the issue of fake news, to kind of change reality, to make a different reality prevailing in the hearts and minds of people, bringing them closer to what they think the perception is, what the perception is of politics, kind of trying to underpin this with fake news is, of course, also a very important tendency, as we see with state-sponsored misinformation, propaganda, often linked to electoral campaigns. And, of course, I don't have to refer to the recent examples like the abuse of data from Facebook by Cambridge Analytica. And, of course, cyber insecurity increasingly becomes a threat for this for democracy because it's used, that insecurity, to spread these simplistic narratives. And so we will have to think, I think, as democracies, about how to more efficiently regulate activities of these new GAFA, these new global companies that handle all these important data. The third phenomenon we see, and that is illustrated in our study, is the fact that corruption, state capture, and the nexus between politics on the one side and organized crime on the other side, these are still amongst the main threats to democracy. It used already to be the case in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. But contrary to positive developments in other attributes of democracy that we prove in statistics, like, for instance, citizens' engagement that has increased, also some in the field of checks on government, fundamental rights, progress has been made, but in terms of corruption, state capture, things are worse than 40, 50 years ago. So corruption, the rule of law, there we have not experienced the same kind of progress. And of course, the increased influx of big money, the role money plays in electoral campaigns, think about these enormous figures in the US, for instance, this biases the fundamental equality of democracy. Democracy, in our definition, is a system where the exercise of public authority is monitored, decided at the end by citizens, and where there is equality in the exercise of that right to monitor public authority. Well, money biases, endangers this equality as a fundamental precondition to have a qualitative democracy. So this is a third negative development. The fourth one, which is very closely related to corruption, is the decreasing levels of trust. People kind of have the perception that politics are not delivering anymore. This, of course, has multiple reasons. It has, for instance, one of the reasons is the very limited impact politics today have on very important domains of societal development. Think about European Union, for instance, where we used to have publicly owned enterprises, where we used to have mandatory military service, where we used to have very important issues debated and discussed but decided by public authorities. We have free market, globalization, and we have a kind of pulling out of public authorities on decisive domains. And increasingly, some people, number one, what is politics still about? Does it still matter to me? Does it still play a role? And number two, there's the feeling of a lack of delivery. These politicians, because of the fact that ideologies are kind of fading away as a decisive factor of choice. They have increasingly to be competitive by promising all kinds of stuff, but this is a kind of contrary to the real impact they have, given the fact also that politics pulled out of very important domains. So there is a real decrease in the level of trust by citizens. There has always been a problem with trust in politicians, but we see the last 10, 15 years that the figures, the statistics that relate to that issue of trust of people in politics are really dramatically negatively developing. To summarize, the core of the problem there is the interaction between citizens and political authorities, where people feel that, well, lots of people feel that politicians, political parties are approaching problems of the 21st century with kind of 19th century ideologies and using political parties as a typically 20th century tool to convince people, to interact with people. And so they feel that what is happening, what is used as tools to rule a country, these tools are not adapted to the 21st century problems. And so if political parties don't manage to innovate, to renew themselves, to restructure them, to become effective again, to gain the trust of the people, you see that in lots of countries worldwide, in all cases where they don't manage to do that, they just disappear. They disappear very rapidly. In 1 or 2 years, they just fade away, phase out of the political landscape. Last but not least for the negative is, of course, migration. I mean, the lack of integration of migrating people, from the one hand, by not giving them enough opportunities to politically integrate, the other hand, also the part of migrants not picking up sometimes the rights they have, the responsibilities also to be part of a society. This gives tension to add, of course, extreme terrorism, to add all kinds of phenomena we see that challenge the democratic governance and that add to the arguments of nationalists, simplists, populists. However, of course, the picture is not only negative. And I would like to point at a couple of positive things. As I mentioned before, very typical for our study is that for our report is that we take a horizon of more than 40 years of statistics. And so given that very wide scope and very long-term perspective, we still can say that in the 70s, something like a quarter to a third of countries could be really called democratic based on representation via elections. We still have now, well, that developed to almost two-thirds in 2016 that have fully-fledged competitive elections and, let's say, the basics of a democratic governance. And notwithstanding the issues I just described, and also in some troubles in some specific countries, this is still the fact now. So democracy actually shows some resilience. We had this upward trend during 40 years, and the numbers are still very high. We still see that more than two-thirds of the countries are democracies. Second positive trend is that the political representation of women went up. It's still a shame that only 22, 23, I think also in the Commonwealth, 22, 23 on average of the parliamentary seats is in the hands of women. That's still a shame, and it's not using sufficiently the talents and capacity and potential of societies, but still it's improvement since some 20, 30 years ago, and the dynamics are quite positive. Very typically also countries of the south most showing the right directions. Currently, countries like Bolivia, like Rwanda, to name a few, are showing the right direction. Third positive development, but it's it's one with two flips. It's the impact of social media. It's very clear that it's on the one hand an advance for democracy, the growth of internet, because it has revolutionized access to information, managed to bring elected leaders potentially closer to their citizens, amplified the voices of citizens and transformed interactions in the political arena. But of course, as Helen Clark has mentioned, there are also very important downsides. I think the main one being what I would call their role in the uberization of politics. We used to have a political practice based on verticality, on formality, on in a national, let's say, constituency, of course, with local authorities, politics going quite slow. I remember when I started in politics and led the party that the Sunday evening, the teams that we picked to discuss the Monday, that they would last a week. Now you have, I don't know, WikiLeaks or whatever, and after a couple of hours, people have to resign in countries. So, that example shows the speed of politics now. The indirect access was prevailing. Now we have very easy access, or people want very easy access. Typical for politics in the 20th century was quite a rigidity, where now everything has to be fluid. So this uberization of politics as a consequence of the massification of the easier access to politics and the spread of information through internet is also a very important, not only negative development, but also a very important challenge to representative democracy that per definition is to a certain extent vertical, per definition is to a certain extent formal, slower, indirect, and to a certain extent rigid. Let me conclude. So I gave you five positive developments and 3 to 4 more negative ones as a kind of appetizer to go into our study and to see more. Let me conclude with abusing the remaining time to point at 2 products we produced with International ID. We are an intergovernmental organization, only produce public goods that are freely available for all citizens in the world. And we have developed 2 specific tools for local authorities, local politics. We strongly believe that local politics is, and the way local politicians, local authorities can function is one of the best contra-arguments to combat the backsliding of democracy. And in terms of capacity building, these are 2 of the tools that we quite successfully use for the time being. It's on the one hand what we call the democratic accountability and service delivery tool. It's a kind of checklist and methodology to do capacity building on the local or regional level to empower people to hold the leaders of, political leaders, but also leaders of public enterprises or public services accountable in terms of, for instance, we tested in some places, some countries, the quality of childcare, doing capacity building for mothers to check the quality of childcare, water distribution, water sanitation, garbage collection, and so on. So this is a very practical tool to offer people a kind of checklist where they can easily organize their activities to be a bit of a counterweight towards political leadership, political people or appointees that are supposed to serve them in terms of a good delivery and service. The second one is a state of local democracy assessment framework. We have this on the national level also. For instance, we are now implementing this in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, where people sit together and use this tool to organize themselves, let's say, outside of the normal political parties, to be a part of civil society that organizes the public debate about how government is doing, how parliament is performing, how administrations are performing. I'm just doing a bit of advertising publicity for these 2 tools. To conclude, thank you very much for having me here. Looking forward to the debate. And thank you, Helen, for 10 years ago in Bucharest.
Here to the table for the panel discussion. So once again, coming to the table now is, in addition to Eves and Helen, is Daryl Bradley, Tony Travers, and Helena Zaum. And the first thing that I'd like to do to kick off the conversation is to ask our other panelists respond to what Helen and Eves had to say, but also to bring any particular perspectives of their own. In some cases, it might be familiarity with law or with ICTs or with transformations in the scale or organization of governance, and any particular insights that you have from your particular areas of expertise that might shed further light on what they've been saying. So those two issues, one is anything in particular, bits of your knowledge that you want to add to this, but also responding to Helen and Eve's. Why don't we start with you, Tony? Is that okay?
Sure, yeah. Well, first, I'd like to say, also on behalf of the LSE, how glad we are to have these documents and these distinguished speakers here with us this evening. It's a great opportunity to think about some of the constitutionally important issues that these documents and indeed the first two speakers, Helen and Eve, have raised. And I'd just say two or three things, really, to support that. One is that it is important to have international comparisons and broadly, easily read across international comparative data and indeed documents, because without that, you know, it is easy for anybody who doesn't spend a great deal of time travelling or studying one country's system to think, well, this is all there is in the world. You know, this is the only way it can be. That's not true in any country. Travel broadens the mind, international study broadens the mind. With that in mind, I think learning about the way other systems, other countries deal with democratic challenges, some of which are very different, many of which are the same, that's very important. Which takes me to the issue that's already been raised this evening by both our speakers, really, which is the growth of a distrust in politics and the roots of that distrust and its consequences. And it seems to me that one of the problems we face is that there is an iteratively bad relationship between the difficulty politicians, particularly at the national level, dare I say it, confronting electorates with very difficult trade-offs. All politics is about rationing and trade-offs, and the nearer you are to the local level, the more politicians are forced to do it and defend it locally. I think at the national level, and I know both our guests here this evening have been national politicians as well as interested in local government, so I don't want to be in any way disrespectful. But I do think that, and you can see it in the UK a lot, that if politicians were to present people with the trade-offs, they'd understand policy better. And in this country, if I can take Britain as an example, most politicians want to offer Sweden's public services with America's taxes. And they will not confront the inconsistency of that. They will not say either that you're all going to have to pay more taxes, or alternatively, the state cannot do all the things we're trying to offer it. And that leads to people feeling that the state is failing. And my third point is this. Local government, because it has legitimacy in many countries, most here represented, of elections, and some tax-raising capacity, I personally wish it were more, it is more in some countries, has legitimacy. And that gives it a constitutional role, well beyond anything a written constitution. Now, New Zealand and the UK and Israel, as it happens, don't have written constitutions. I think Israel is looking at it. But the truth is, in countries, whether you have a constitution or not, the existence of other politicians and the training that brings for people who can move up the system, and the fact that, you know, local government may often be in the hand of the oppositions compared with the national government, or whatever levels of government are, sometimes three, sometimes four, then this is good too, because there is a constitutional role for local government and a check and a balance, an automatic publicly accessible check and balance that makes far more sense to most people than a written document. Now, you might say somebody from Britain would say that, but I actually think you can have both, and both are important.
Thank you, Tom.
Elena? Yeah, lovely. Thank you very much. And again, I'm delighted to be able to speak to you all this evening. So, I think it has been very well covered by both Helen and Eve that with the technical revolution that we're all living through at the moment, there are some tremendous challenges. Certainly that's something that we take very seriously. And actually, we're about to launch a program in the US to actually look at how technology can try and steady the ship when it comes to democracies and elections. So I'm excited to see how that pans out. And I think the midterms in the US will be the guinea pig that we will then look to hopefully perpetuate the good learnings, hopefully, from that experience. I think technology does have a tremendous role to play, though, in helping us engage with those people who, through mistrust in the system, have exited. You know, clearly there is a need to make sure that we don't all live in our social media echo chambers, and I think there's a very important role for us all to learn, actually, about identifying fake news. And I certainly, maybe some of you in the audience will recall sessions at school where we were all taught about the different political persuasions of newspapers. Mm-hmm. That would be a much more complex task, but it needs doing. We have some really interesting examples, having said that, of where social media has been really used to get at parts of the population that normally are disaffected with public service. So it's not an example from this booklet, but the Met Police here in the UK has done some wonderful work with Twitter, and they're actually using Twitter for their citizens to report crimes, and they can actually look at Twitter feeds on a geographic basis and try and identify where there are likely to be issues. In the future, perhaps, football hooliganism and all of that sort of thing. So that's really, I think, a real positive example of using some of these platforms for good effect. If I think about another common response to distrust, the business of voice. So I'm not an academic, but I believe that a certain Mr. Hirschman has some good things to say on this topic. Technology clearly is a great way for citizens to have their say, and there's some really lovely examples in the booklet, notably from India, where the central government has used technology as a platform both to empower agents who are going out into the field to pick up responses to particular projects, but that's actually then also been extended out to citizens and is actually now gathering their feedback about particular projects which are looking to deal with issues of poverty. I think we need to be careful. We're very concerned at Microsoft about what we call the digital divide. It's fine for all of us. We sit here making notes on our smartphones, but we need to think very carefully about the role of technology in democracy and make sure that everybody has access to it. And once again, there's a couple of nice examples in the booklet, thinking about actually the digital fabric of a smart city and some of the things that can be done to make sure that everybody is included.
My perspective comes from the situation of a small, less developed society. Belize is a city of only 6,000 or 7,000 people, and we are located in Central America, which is one of the most violent parts of the world. Local government within the Belizean context is very empowered. We're doing a lot of things that are very innovative. But I think that there are some serious systemic challenges which explains a little bit about the issue of populism. My perspective here would be that there's a significant degree of correlation between populism and inequality, both social and political inequality. And you see throughout the world, it's been mentioned by the panelists quite thoroughly, but there is a degree that there's a feeling that governments throughout the world are failing. You're not providing goods and services, you're not delivering to persons, and the situation is that populism thrives when there's a lack of credibility, there's a lack of trust, there's a lack of confidence in democratic institutions and the recognition that democratic institutions can really provide goods and services and improvements in equality of life for individuals. So one of my views or perspectives is that I think governments, both at the central and local government level, need to really focus on social and economic inequalities. It's a huge, huge problem throughout the world. And there's a disdain for populism. But one of the things that I want to share is we should ask ourselves why the populist is so popular. We should look at the strategies and why is it that a majority of our population are going to these leaders. There's a feeling there that if I live in the desert, I'll drink the sand. So the idea is that if a populist can provide even rhetoric you're going to go to the popularists. What we need to do is that we need to infuse ourselves in terms of democratic institutions, and we really need to reform and refocus to ensure that we are providing basic human living conditions which are acceptable. I'm very mindful that in terms of a significant amount of the conversation, it's about basics. A significant amount of the world's population don't access basic services. I love being at the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. Being in England, the situation is vastly different from the reality that I come from, that basic human services, citizen security, housing, education, the equality of women, these are things that we really need to tackle as a global community. And I think local government really is poised to addressing some of these conditions seriously. If we think about empowering local communities, empowering them in very meaningful and specific ways, and we look at ensuring that governments at our level are truly representative, and we recognize and redress imbalances and inequalities, I think we could go far to combat the rise of populism. The reality is that people just want a good living experience, and they will look towards any leader that they perceive can deliver that. And if we want to combat populism, then we have to be that leader. We have to be those leaders that would provide inclusive, very practical solutions to real challenges that people face.
Why don't we hear from Yves and Helen, and then maybe I'll come back to you one more time. You can engage in dialogue with one another, but also with their responses, and then we'll go to the audience, okay? Yves, why don't you start us?
Thank you very much. So maybe to add on what has been said and to focus on three things. I think indeed, to a certain extent, to protect and strengthen democracy, we have to work on fundamentally on three issues, I would say. Number one is, it was pointed at the pluses of having all these ICT tools freely available and easy to access, although indeed we have to look at the digital divide. The point is, I think, how we can make them as, let's say, tools to strengthen democratic practice and interaction between political authorities, elected people, public authorities, and the citizens. We need, and that's the second point, if we have that good interface, we will be able to answer the enormous, increasingly urgent question of the demand for democracy, not only a democracy of moments, every 4 or 5 years going to a ballot station and cast a vote, but more a fluid interaction between. So I think ICT can help us to complement, to complete representative democracy, still having in place elections as very important moments where we give a mandate to people and we trust people to, based on their program, to work for us, how we see society, but to complement this with a more continuous interaction. I have 3 grown-up kids, young adults, and that's always the question they ask me. Dad, why should we ask for that Sunday morning where we are invited to go to our earlier former school to cast a ballot, and then it's, why shouldn't we be able, like we pay our taxes, to have a more continuous quality check? And we have a range of possibilities, the most extreme one, quote-unquote, being the referendum, and there I think you need a certain practice, and there are pros and cons, and there are preconditions to it. But I think so, quality-wise, good availability of ICT, good use of ICT, to make it complement our representative democracy. The third very important element, and I think there that's a more delicate one, it's the issue of delivery and expectations. Managing expectations and improving delivery. Managing expectations is the responsibility of politicians themselves that are increasingly in kind of competitive situation with postmodern politics not being done based on comprehensive ideologies but more on ad hoc programs. And so on the one hand, this very increased competition that makes people promising, over-promising. And on the other hand, the quality of delivery, improving the quality of delivery, I think that a lot of efforts should supplementary be put in place to achieve the... And I think that there, at the local level in big urban areas, lots of people already are doing a lot. I live part-time in Stockholm, which is a kind of paradise for governance, but also part-time in Paris, and I see that in these two places, local authorities invest a lot in this kind of improving delivery, but also showing to people that things are quite complicated, that it's not so easy to obtain results, to reach objectives.
Perhaps a couple of more comments to add to what I said earlier. Firstly, I think populism is responding to a real mood, a reality, perceptions. There is a squeezed middle class in a lot of developed countries, which has seen globalisation take away what were secure jobs and often replace them with very insecure, casualised work. So people feel worse off than they've been. You know, the mantra of the new global agenda is to leave no one behind, but the reality is that disruptive forces of globalisation and technology have made quite a lot of people feel that things left behind and marginalised, and life is not for them what it was, so they're going to look for political expression for that. And then the populist comes in and can, you know, blame it on Chinese manufacturing or Mexican labour or a free trade deal or something. It all seems so easy, but as I say, there's some bigger forces at work here. And you know, how to ensure ongoing prosperity for people who have been adversely affected by these disruptive trends, I think is one of the big issues many developed countries face. The second reflection I would have is about the influence of social media in politics, and it's a sad commentary in a way that an open society like the American one, which has spawned incredible innovations like Facebook, Twitter, etc., then sees these tools, in a sense, turned against the society, the open politics. You know, the thought that very active troll factories in St. Petersburg can turn these mechanisms against an open society like the US is quite mind-boggling, really. And I still don't think Facebook gets it. You know, they're still looking for, quite technical fixes, but I think there's sort of deeper problems here. Some of the issues, I think, are also about the lack of political literacy, that people find it very difficult to distinguish fact from fiction. And you're right, there was a time when, you know, there was conscious civics education, and you know, you knew what the newspapers stood for, and so you'd look at what they said in that light. But we're like lambs to the slaughter with social media and the possibilities for that which we, you know, many don't fully understand at all. So how to make social media, you know, force for more constructive politics and not the destruction that we've seen with such widespread interference in the democratic processes, I think is quite a big issue.
I'm going to call on myself for 1 minute because I think there's an interesting discussion underlying a lot of what you're saying, and that is, if we keep in mind the graph that Yves had on the board from the Global State of Democracy report, which showed that more and more countries have become democratic over the last 40 years. So we have this nice upward moving graph to more and more democracy. That graph looks a lot like the graph for Gini coefficient, and that is increasing inequality, which you're raising quite specifically, Daryl, but I also think it's part of what we're talking about. We're talking about lack of trust, or that's it. At least you were laying the blame for that quite directly there. And to some extent, we're looking at social media or ICTs as sort of part of the problem, but it also makes me wonder if there's a basic problem with the way democracy itself is practiced. And I know that in the report, there are lots of dimensions of democracy which are considered and measured, but I'm wondering how much that misses changes in the actual nature of what these practices are and how that might be moving underneath sort of the radar of the measures in the report. So I just want to throw that out there as an idea because I do think that's a linking theme, but I wanted to put that on the table as something that we might be missing. Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think in fairness to the new media, I mean, a number of the phenomena that by implication we're discussing were at play and having an effect on government and politics, you know, 50, 60 years ago. If you track the decline of, you know, the big party domination of countries that had big parties, the fragmentation predates the coming of the opportunity for everybody effectively to be their own broadcaster and editor. Having said that, there's no doubt that that last of possibility does make it easier for the fragmentation to be reinforced and to go completely out of control. And that is the thing. So it's like, and you can see from all of this how eventually people say, well, let's have a simple solution and a simple leader. A referendum that will sort everything out. A powerful authoritarian leader who will answer everything. This will make it simpler. And of course, it doesn't. What it does is mask the complexity. And if I, you know, I'm a big believer, thank goodness, given where we are this evening, in competitive democracy. But I can see that, particularly in the Westminster model, given that we're here, you know, in part because of the Commonwealth heads of government, that the competition that goes on in almost all democracies can be seen both as a positive, I do, but also as a negative, as all the, in a sense, the official opposition, or whatever it's called, you know, batters the government. And we all believe, yeah, the government's bad, and then the opposition gets in, then they're bad. And it's sort of, without seeing the bigger picture, which is that this leads to improvement and a rising standard of living, which in, you know, most democracies it has, and very rapidly indeed, actually. So, you know, this is why the study of government politics is so interesting.
Yves, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah, very briefly, I would like to underline or to adhere to the point made by Tony. On the reasons why this populism and nationalism there is now. Indeed, it started earlier, and I think that it started earlier than ICT. It's also related to what I very briefly mentioned, the end of the very comprehensive structuring ideologies, where now more and more in this postmodern political world, it's not so much about a global vision on man and society, it's more on like a bit of a supermarket conversation. You get this from me, and I promise you this, but what the idea behind this is more difficult. And this coincides with the destructuring of society, with, of course, the end of religion, very big civil society organizations that lose their impact and are regressing, and to a certain extent, nothing has come in place, and this brings a lot of volatility, a lot of diffused dispersing of political power. For instance, this volatility is really spectacular. If you see in most of the democracies all over the globe, in the 90s, in the first decade of this century even, elections were, you could win elections behind the comma, as we would say in my country. You won elections with a plus one or minus one or minus two. Now you have people that just start to campaign or to be known 1 year on beforehand, and they win elections. Or you have a country like France, for instance, where the president first wins elections and then thinks, I need
to have a party.
and so this is a totally different world we are in, mm-hmm. and which underlines the necessity now to try to improve again that interface between citizens and political authorities to make it more fluid and more adapted to this liberalized world. There is no reason why politics would be a kind of exception to the other societal dynamics. We see in all parts of society, people want direct access, they want easy access, they want fluid interaction, they don't want to give their mandate for a long period, they are very volatile in their ideas, so it's, and I think that's the crucial issue.
I mean, to add to this, I mean, we've arrived at a point this very year, really, where one of the leading capitalist countries, you know, pressing for more free trade is a communist regime. Yeah. And the leading capitalist, the most successful capitalist in the world, country in the world, is sort of tending to close the doors. That's how complicated it's become. That is a complication. It is hard for us all to hold that in our minds, I think.
One of the things that I wanted to interject very quickly is, as a result of this, I think leadership skills are changing. And what is required of a good leader is changing.
And
there's a gap, and I find this in my own experience being a mayor. You have to exist on two levels. You have to be a technical person. You go to conferences, you read reports, you analyze situations, and you target and deal with very complex problems. But you also have to live on a plane that connects with people. A lot of leadership now is emotionalism. This uberization results in people really wanting simplistic answers. And successful leaders will be those who can, in part, give simplistic answers, but recognize the big picture behind the scenes. And you're seeing this reality emerge in many democracies, including developed societies and less developed societies, that people are turning to leaders who they feel can deliver. Whether or not they can or cannot will be left to history. But successful politicians have to be those who would exist on both planes. You have to know the answer, and you also have to be able to explain it to people in a very simplistic way and connect.
Helena? Last word before we do our
Yeah, I mean, really interesting points, all of those, and very much interested in what you were speaking about almost the fragmentation of existing systems, and clearly, if you put fragmentation into an echo chamber, the results can be really quite shocking and quite horrifying. So, GDPR, I hope, will come in and will start to stabilise the ship, but. I think the other point that you've made was that there's no reason why politics should be behind the rest of the world with this revolution. But sadly, all of the all of the regulation is. And so, to a certain extent, I'm sure it was the same when the printing press came out. But we need to adapt, and the regulation needs to grow. And dare I say, we need to future-proof that a little bit. We speak a lot about future-proofing in technology. That's kind of baked into most technologies these days. But actually, we need to start thinking about that in terms of regulation as well. There's a lot of talk about sort of fail-fast, agile methodology. If you think about sort of setting up new businesses and innovations, which is another dimension on this sort of smart city agenda, we need to start somehow doing that, I think, with some of the the policy decisions that were made, and obviously international collaboration around how this stuff can be effective.
Terrific. Why don't we go to the audience? I'm going to take three questions right off the bat. If you want to direct your question to a particular member of the panel, do indicate that. So if you'd like to ask a question, let me see your hands. Okay, right back here first.
This is really a question directed towards Ms. Clark, but for all of you, anyone. But it has to do with what we were talking about before, about how to keep voters engaged and how to get them participating again, and ties in a little bit to social media, which does keep them engaged. But I'm glad you touched on the issue of education, because this is something I really firmly believe we have to do more on. Now, I can only speak for my own country, I'm from Canada, but I know in the last 10 years in Canada there's been a big tail-off in civic education, and that money in university systems has tended to go towards engineering and business and has de-emphasized the social sciences and civics and things that I would normally say help people be more engaged on a level at a time when we are increasingly finding populist saying, we don't want experts, we don't want people who know a lot about this sort of thing. Is there a role there for local government to play in supporting that kind of civic education and civic engagement?
Okay, let me take two more questions from the floor before we... Yes?
Hi, this is a question sort of for the whole panel, but I suppose particularly appropriate for Ms. Zung. What about AI? You talk about future-proofing technologies, and I'm also very interested from an educational perspective. I've been a teacher for a few years now, about the sort of lack of trust that young people who cannot yet vote display in democracy and the very preconceived opinions they come to, and frankly, the scary apathy with which they regard democracy. And it seems to come very much from a helplessness, a learned helplessness about, well, I can't change anything, we can't change anything. Palace,
do you think AI has a role to
play in either combating that, or indeed in perhaps protecting against AI potentially exacerbating that?
Okay, one more.
Yeah. Based on everything, it's really complicated, and media's going everywhere, and it's really hard to find out. Are we asking too much of the average Joe or the average Joanne to really get involved in politics? And if there's a way of making it easy for them, where does it come from? Does it come from education from the bottom, or does it come from control from the top? Is it the government to start looking at media then to be in danger of free press?
Okay. Helen, I think the first question is directed straight to you.
Well, tough questions. I'll offer an opinion that may not be particularly informed on, but I think that a number of our countries have seen education go down quite a narrow track of wanting to test knowledge and very narrow things, leading to teachers having to teach to the test, being able to be less creative and innovative in educating the whole child as a thinker and a creative person. So, can we be surprised that in a way a result of this is then narrowing into education being what you need to get you a job rather than the education of someone for society, for life, and the broader sense. And it would be good to hear some more debate around that and more support for the liberal education, the liberal arts. I remember an era at my old university, Auckland, where at the engineering school everyone had to do liberal studies. It was a very deliberate effort in some of those narrow technical schools to nonetheless try and broaden education. But you don't hear so much about that now. It's all about getting that qualification and not being educated so much about the society that you're entering. So I think all that is a problem. What can local government do? Well, local government, I think, because it's close to the people, and people probably have a clearer idea of where their money goes in local government, right? It's often collected for quite purposes that are quite clear, rather than the great sinkhole that tends to be central government, taxation and so on. Maybe we need to hear more about the transformational leadership in local government that does build trust, does show direction, does engage. Maybe it's easier to achieve that, particularly in the larger complex societies than it is at the national level. New Zealand is quite a small, intimate democracy, so you can do things that perhaps may be more like local government in character. But in a society like the British or the American, I think we could see local government lead a build back for trust and engagement.
Yeah, lovely. I have a question around AI and potentially its role in either encouraging or discouraging an already disaffected youth. And I think what I'd like to do is sort of broaden AI out and actually look what's underneath AI is actually data. Now, I think that we live in very, very exciting times from a data perspective. It's all over the news. I think that there's an opportunity to more readily share information and data about the actual impact rather than the perceived impact and the kind of tit-for-tat type government that we have a lot of here in the UK, and actually share with the population the real impact of particular policies, then data could actually be a really, really useful tool in this debate. And there's a couple of little examples in here. So there's an AIDS program, and they've published all their figures so that people can see what they've done and what the impact was. And it feels very facile, but actually I don't think that we're terribly good at doing that. I think it's very important, particularly from a financial point of view, to reinforce that decisions that we all made actually turned themselves into policies and then into action. And certainly, as Helen said, it tends to be at a local level, but it's a bit easier to unpick what's happened in a particular project. So I suppose my guidance would be, wouldn't it be wonderful if we can A, use data to inform, and I think the generation that you're talking to and communicating with will be much more accustomed to doing that, but then perhaps also to get them more involved in local politics. Nesta, which is an organisation here in the UK, has recently published a paper looking at participatory finance. And it's quite interesting just to read some of the citizen comments. And they all say, well, that was really cool. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't realise how complicated it was. Yeah. And actually, I think that's a nice way forward on that front. So those would be my comments.
Any of the other panelists like to comment on the questions?
Well, just quickly in relation to the question on is it too much for the average Joe, and I think this is where local government really can provide a space for engaging individuals. If you have discussions that are very macro at the national level, that may be a little bit too abstract. People may not be able to plug in or feel that they're connected, but local government can fill that space because you're really dealing with things that may be important to individuals, my garbage, my neighborhood, my parks, the local economy within my space. When I graduate, will I have a meaningful job? And so if local government continues to tackle on those specific things and provide meaningful ways for individuals to interact and plug into things which really are important to you, it can serve as a useful mechanism to plug into some of these things which may be not beyond, but it may confuse the average individual.
Yeah, well, just to add that, I mean, there is, if you look at the UK, in the UK here at the moment, there is evidence that local government is more trusted than national government. Polls show it quite clearly. And I think that is because local politicians have to demonstrate quite close to people that they're wrestling with the trade-offs that are so important in government. That's very clear. Two other quick points. One is that I do think when it comes to trust, I don't think everybody expects government to do everything that they individually think should happen. But they definitely feel they want politicians who take their views seriously and weigh it up, even if they then reject it. And that, I think, is how we convince more people that that is the case, I think, is really important. Then, as far as civic education is concerned, you know, I think schools and universities obviously have a role in this. And getting people to read things and argue about things they don't agree with and debate positions that are the opposite of what they actually believe in, I do think is an important thing. I'm sure as politicians, must have had to do quite a lot of that over the years, but I think that for young people, but I do think that trying to argue a case you don't believe in, just to see, thinking to other people's minds, is an important skill we could help teach people.
Do you have anything you'd like to say about these questions?
I don't think there's so much to add, maybe three things only. We have evidence indeed that countries, nations where power and also budgetary means are more decentralized, deconcentrated, perform better in terms of the trust of the people in public authority and public policy. So that's an evidence. Number two is referring to ICT, artificial intelligence. There are lots of positive potentialities in these new tools. Think about the increased possibilities to structure transparency, accessibility of data, transparency in terms of activities of, think about procurement, for instance, tendering in a very transparent way. Last but not least, I think that there is a role for, we can't leave it up to the politicians to solve the issue. I think that all stakeholders in democracy, and per definition it's all the citizens, but stakeholders like the media, like academics also, like organizations, civil society, we all have a role, and I would say it's one of the roles is to force politics to be, instead of being big on small things and small on big things, to concentrate on big issues and try to deliver on big issues, but also to bring reality back. I learned throughout my political career that there is a misunderstanding about politics, that politics, people think, and most of politicians, the candidates promise it, people think that politics is there to solve problems. Well, I can tell you, most of the problems we are faced with, you can't solve them. You can at the best manage them and try to make them less damaging. But that kind of true message, more realistic messaging, and then to concentrate on big issues and through media, academics, and other stakeholders, force politicians, also force citizens to base their choice based on these big issues, I think would also help a lot.
So I think we have time for two more quick questions. I would ask the questioners to be brief, but let's throw it out there for two more quick questions.
Is the rise of populism the result of the failure of the neoliberal
consensus? Neoliberal consensus. Okay.
So I'd like to ask you, what do they think democracy businesses worldwide, and really be expected to flourish unless there is real wealth redistribution between the rich and the poor countries.
Okay. Neoliberal consensus and wealth distribution. Why don't we just go, Helen, do you want to start?
I do have a view that the way globalization proceeded created a world where capital investment could move freely, but where the benefits weren't obvious to a lot of the population. And I think in a way the societies that have come through these disruptive trends somewhat better, like the Scandinavian ones, are ones which put a lot of investment into upskilling people, retooling them, perhaps more intelligent strategies for the relocation of labour and so on. And we're going to need to do all that with bells on, with the fifth industrial revolution and so on. If we don't invest in people and their skills and capacities, we're going to have a very jaundiced population which isn't supported to make the transition required. So I think the message is that the smart and active state is actually pretty important in managing transitions, and a lot of states were missing in action with the deepening of globalization and the disruptive force of technology.
Tony?
Well, I mean, I strongly agree with that. And the challenge for governments is that, as with the next industrial revolution, if we try and stop it, that won't work. So the question is exactly how does politics manage it and stop people feeling completely left behind? And in the matter of redistribution, the trouble is there's a two-phase business here. In every single country, a need for it, and between countries. And it's hard enough within one country, very difficult across international boundaries for all sorts of reasons that even non-populist politicians understand. In the end, taking taxpayers' money from one country and spending it outside that country produces a reaction, and it's not purely populist to whip that up or feel it. So, we can go as fast as the international community can encourage countries collectively to go, and that's why organisations like those here represented publish documents like this and speak at events of this kind.
Joe?
I do think that this issue of wealth distribution is really the challenge of our time. And I think individuals throughout the world, the 9 billion people, they look to governments, both central and local, and they look to international institutions as really providing prosperity. That's a major focus. And I'm mindful of the conversation here about technology and AI and artificial intelligence and so forth. For a significant amount of the world's people, that just goes right over them. I mean, it's really about basics. It's about clean water and safety and security and housing and employment. And I think it's very challenging, but the global community has to ensure that we confront those problems, because we will continue to leave more of the world's population behind. It's a major problem. And I think that democracies throughout the world, less developed countries, have to be challenged to do more. I think one of the problems with governments in the less developed world is that there's really not enough over the last 10 years and going into the sustainable development goals. There must be a major focus on ensuring that we combat poverty and we provide basic living standards for people all throughout the world, or else people will continue to lose confidence in democratic institutions and there will continue to be rises in populism, because people do not feel that they're getting that improvement in their quality of life from the structures that exist today.
Glenn, you have anyone here?
There are two things that I'd say. When we think about infrastructure and some of those basic needs, I think we need, in order to allow those parts of the population who are not yet enjoying that to participate in this economy, we need to make sure that we're thinking about digital infrastructure as a basic need. And you know, the other piece then is all around digital skills. It's very, very important that we do that, and you know, whether that's in school, whether that's through apprenticeships, or whether or not it's through ongoing education, and really helping those people. I mean, so I agree that we're, you know, we really, really have to make sure that we're sharing these skills also, because otherwise the number of people who are on the other side of the line, as it were, is only going to grow. So yeah, absolutely echo that, but skills and digital infrastructure, I think, need to be major focus areas for us.
Steve, do you have anything you want to add to close this up?
Well, my last thoughts would be positive. I mean, well, positive flavor. You will see in the report that a part of the report, a chapter, proves that in terms of democracy, it's not so much a problem of the demand, decreasing demand. People really want a say in their future and want a say in how their country is governed. The issue is more the delivery. What is currently available as democracy is not really meeting their expectations. And I would like to add to the rising inequalities a couple of other aspects that could bring us further in other debates. There's also the issue of double delegation. It has been described in a book written by an English journalist. The fact that people vote on a Sunday morning or whatever day, then in the evening they see other people than the ones that they voted for on the TV screens starting to build coalitions, and then these coalitions have to give a kind of mandate to technocrats because issues are so complex. And so out of that whole process of voting, at the end of the, let's say, the production line, they don't find anything back of what they wanted to have as an influence. So this issue of double delegation is important. Besides that, the fact that it's mentioned before, this very broad coalitions without real identity, where people see that all these politicians that have been competing for their voice at the end of the day have to sit together to form a majority, given the fact that votes are now very thinly spread over different parties, that gives a bit of the same. They say, well, does it make a difference still to go out voting? So people want to have a say, but it's the issue, so that's a positive element. They continue to want to have more democracy, even in the countries backsliding, and with lots of issues in the functioning of democracy, but they are not happy with what is currently available as kind of democratic offer. So we have to continue to invest on that offer, but that's easier said than done.
Okay, so before we close, I'm going to bring to the podium Greg Monroe. He's the Secretary General of the Commonwealth Local Government Forum, which, of course, is the organization that's heavily responsible for having everybody here today.
Thank you. So I'll be very quick doing thanks and launching the handbook. So first of all, thank you to the organizing trio, the three organizations, LSE Cities, International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, and, of course, my own organization, Commonwealth Local Government Forum. Thanks to our patron, Helen Clark, for your wonderful support of us, for your speech, and your description of the handbook, so I don't now have to do it. Thank you very much. To Eve Letourneau, for your speech and your sterling work you're doing supporting democratic institutions and processes, and for your report, The Global State of Democracy. To the panelists, Daryl Bradley, who's on my executive committee, and from Belize, Tony Travers from RPA and LSE, and Helena Zahn, sitting next to Microsoft, with whom we have a global partnership. Not her, it was Microsoft. And of course, Michael for chairing this evening. So there it is. We launch this every 2 years, normally at our conference, but this, our last conference in November, we launched the mini-me version, which was easier to carry. We thought it would be better to launch this during Dragon Week. It's thicker than what it was last time, which I think is a good sign, which means we've got more information, but we've actually also added stuff on national urban policies and localising of SDGs into this, which is new. I'm particularly proud of the four, page 7, which monitors women councillors, and we work with UN Women in New York, helping them to monitor this as part of SDG 5. It's evolving. So you'll see it's already out of date because it talks about 52 countries. Yeah. And it's now 53. So it gets updated on a regular basis online. So the Gambia will be added online. I suspect there might be a few more added before the end of the year, maybe at least one. It's an enormous amount of work to do. So my deputy Lucy is sitting there. She's had quite a few more grey hairs since she's been trying to lead on this, because it's a lot of work. So Lucy, thank you very much. Gareth, where's Gareth? Yeah, thank you very much, Gareth, for all your hard work on this. And of course, most importantly, the contributions from our members, many of whom are sitting in the audience. Thank you for all the work you've done on this. There it is. Please help yourself on the way out. The handbook is launched.